All right. Thank you so much for tuning in to listener-supported WDRT 91.9 on your dial. You are listening to The Skeptical Naturopath with Dr. Paul Rattay and Christina DeRocher. This is part two, but you can jump in anywhere because Paul repeats himself.
Oh, I do. Do I?
And we're talking about the protein leverage hypothesis. I'm just teasing. We know where we want to start off anyway, so it's all good.
Yeah, but so we're just continuing the conversation, but not, no, many people aren't continuing the conversation, or maybe we make them listen to the other one. So can you give a synopsis of the protein leverage hypothesis before we start?
Oh, geez. Okay.
You've got the little graph, though. You've got the picture there.
Yes, I do.
And you've got words. You could just read that, but it won't be as good as if you read it, because I'll know you're reading it.
Right. It's a test.
It's a test.
So there's an x-axis of protein, and as we increase protein, we necessarily will feel a higher satiety rate, and we can balance that, if we want, with carbohydrates and fats, which would be technically a y-axis on a graph. So we can be unbalanced in both low and too high protein in relation or ratio to carbs and fat. And what we're really looking for is to lead, that's protein leverage, leading with protein and finishing off, so to speak, if there's still hunger or need for more energy with carbs and fats. And we want to basically find that sweet spot, that N of one for our, again, I'm going to use more macrobiotics, and say that we want to eat for our destiny. We want to take into consideration whether or not we're weightlifting or have seven children or lugging tires for a living or sitting behind a desk or a musician. That's all going to have an effect on how we moderate protein and carb fat ratio.
Yep. And I would only add that it works in the background, right? So this is what drives us to eat or potentially not eat. So for meeting our protein demands, again, in a gram dosing, the amount that we need, then we won't be hungry. So in
exactly.
other words, eating higher concentration of protein will lead to satiety quicker. And, you know, they've done some experiments on this where they'll take people, like they give them an all-you-can-eat buffet and they control what's on the buffet, right? So that it's either higher protein or not. So the foods, and then they'll do it in other cases where they'll let them choose the foods that they want to eat to try to get a sense of, can we sort of replicate this? They've done it in animals too. And, but I think that, you know, human, can we translate animal studies to human studies? But again, what's really interesting is the two authors, I can't remember their names. They wrote the book Eat Like the Animals. And they're two entomologists, and they were studying locust feeding, right? When locusts swarm, like why do they swarm and what causes them to stop? And they're actually swarming because they're trying to increase their protein intake, and they'll have to eat more food in order to get the protein that they need.
Yeah, and I would posit that there are two things that human beings need to overcome in order to eat like animals. And one is our feeling life, because we eat our feelings. We have fond memories of familial connections to food. We are in social settings where we feel it's necessary to imbibe in the food and drink that's being offered. And then the second thing would be that we want to make sure that we are not going for all flavor, because you won't survive if you really want to eat more protein and you want it to be a natural source. You kind of have to tamp down that idea that every meal has to be super exciting and, you know, flavorful. Even though I like the meat that I eat, it is definitely not as varied in flavor as all of the vegetables and beans and grains and even greens and definitely seaweeds that I've had in my life, you know.
Boring.
Really, it's boring, and it's effective, efficient more than it's feeling life.
Correct.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
yes.
Like I say, I feel like a lot of what human beings struggle with when they struggle with what to eat is overcoming what everybody else is doing, and that includes old family habits or old ways that we picked up when we were in college or social settings. I feel like we, you know, I mean, and I can say this from experience, every restaurant I ever worked at in my 20s, I was always called the bunny. Oh, here comes the rabbit. She brought her little salad today. And I was always teased and ostracized, and I'm fine with it now. It was very painful in my 20s. But I look back and I say, I'm just one of those people who was willing to sacrifice fitting in for this macrobiotic, you know, voyage that I was on. It was so much more important for me to bring my food than to get free fries at the restaurant where I worked, you know?
Yes. So perhaps your upbringing was different than mine, right? I mean, I grew up like you don't throw food away, right? Free food is like, you're going to use it. Like my mom taught me really well. We don't throw food away. So I'm like, free fries. Are you kidding me? Free food. I'm going to eat it. Yes. I've since learned that, but it took me longer than my 20s to get over that.
Yeah, well, I was raised very similarly to you. I spent all my allowance on candy. We had tamales in a jar. You had to peel off the paper before you cooked them. I never had those. I'm telling you, my brother and I think, actually were the first ones to invent marshmallow fluff, because we would microwave it in a paper plate as we were latchkey kids and would feed ourselves after school. And I put feed in quotes. And that's why I think I was so attracted to macrobiotics, because it was a complete 180 from what I grew up on. I mean, I had TV dinners and watched the McNeil Lair News Hour during dinner, you know? So I totally relate to that. But then something clicked at 19. You know, I had a boyfriend from poetry class at community college, and he brought his own lunch. And I was like, what are you doing? You brought your own lunch? I thought we were going to go out. And he's like, oh, no, you know, I eat a special way. I don't really want to talk about it, you know. And it was very clean. There was no packaged food, you know. And I just thought, wow, I've got to investigate that. And then perimenopause, and then the iron deficiency, and then carnivore for 2 weeks, which basically set me off to eat a very much more meat-heavy diet, and still maintained all of the benefits that I thought macrobiotics was giving me. You know, good sleep, good humor, great energy. You know, firm stools, you know, relatively low illness rate, you know, throughout the year. And I thought it was macrobiotics, but it's so interesting to go from one extreme to the other. I mean, really, it's three extremes.
Yeah, get benefit on both of them. Yes, that's what's extremely interesting. So is it just the quality of the diet, or what is it beyond the quality? It's about the concentration, right? It's a concentration of nutrients.
Yeah. I think it's both, because there was quality in both, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I ate only organic in all of macrobiotics, I always just splurged and bought organic whenever it was a possibility, which of course, as we go on, is more and more. And now I'm eating biodynamic meat from Zinnaker Farm over in Elkhorn, you know? So I do think that it's quality. And the more high quality food you eat, even though I was eating three times a day with macrobiotics, and now I eat 1 to 2 times a day with a meat heavy diet, 1 to 2 times a day, and very little at that. Like, my meals are very small. Like, when I go to work, I bring a container of meat. You know, it's maybe just a steak cut up or some meatballs that I can throw in my mouth while I'm cleaning, and a smoothie that I can slurp that's avocado, banana, some oats, some seaweed, a little bit of fruit, and some oat milk. I've been buying some raw milk, but it's very expensive and I can't use enough of it because we're only two people in our household. But I will eventually be swapping all of my alternative milks for raw milk finally. Yeah.
I mean, that's a journey we're on, right? We're all on that journey, and there's many different ways that we can, you know, we get there. I guess it was my early 20s I started to wake up when I lived in Japan, because my digestive system completely turned around. And then I realized there's something going on there.
Yeah. You had that same experience with rice, didn't you? Wasn't that what it was, basically?
Wheat. I mean, I thought it was wheat. I seem to tolerate wheat now. I mean, I don't eat a lot of wheat. Gluten. I mean, I wouldn't have said gluten at the time, but dairy for sure, right? Dairy's an issue. And I mean, I lived in Japan. I ate rice. I ate tofu. I ate chicken. I ate eggs. It's basically what I ate. And I lived on my own for a while, right? Which means I go to the market and I had no money, and that's what I ate. And occasionally a friend would take me out for, you know, sashimi, and oh my gosh, dream about the food in Japan. I mean, unbelievable. But my digestive system completely cleared up. I never knew I had a problem until I didn't have the problem. And then I came back to the United States and I said, well, I need to eat better. I know that. And I ate salad bars, right? So I didn't eat, I gave up fast food, right? That was gone. But my symptoms came back because I was still eating crappy food on the salad bar, right?
Yeah,
dairy, right. And other things, right? So, I mean, again, right? So for me, it was definitely this aspect that I needed to clean up the food that I was eating. And then when I started naturopathic school, right, I was a vegan for 6 months because that's basically what everybody did. Oh my God, I felt terrible. I was so bloated. My digestion was worse. I'm like, I can't eat this way. I remember going in the clinic because we go in the clinic for free. They give me digestive enzymes and teas and all this stuff to try to help my digestive system. I'm like, I just can't. I mean, not that I can't eat vegan food, but that diet 100% doesn't work for me.
Yeah, you have to eat a lot of seeds and nuts, and that's what I find tears you up.
Yes, correct. Yeah, that's my issue, that I'm not opposed to a vegan diet. I'm not a real fond of a low-fat vegan diet, because a vegan diet, I'd say, needs to be nuts and seeds in there, right? I think that's super, super important.
And of course, beans, and those are
always...
Of
course, beans, but that'll be in, that's low-fat, so that fits both
sides.
Yeah,
I'm just talking digestive-wise, it's tough.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, beans, you know, what I've learned with beans is the more I eat beans, the less that I have any problem with them. I used to think lentils and kidney beans killed me. Yes, I mean, the amount of gas that I'd get. But now, nothing. Beans, because I eat them so much. Right.
Okay.
So that's how I kind of work it, that I'm trying not to be so meat heavy. I mean, I eat a fair amount of meat, but the idea is like, oh, well, what if I put some other fiber source in there to kind of dilute the beans? And I kind of like that anyways, right? I kind of geek out about these heirloom beans and that type of thing. And I find that that's, you know, I'm still eating meat, but I'm eating meat within that context. And that seems to work just fine for me. Blood sugar wise and that, it doesn't seem to be as much of a problem. And I actually struggle with my blood sugar, right? My A1C is not so good. I'm wearing my continuous glucose monitor right now, and I'm trying to like fine tune. And you know, you look at me, you'd be like, you're not pre-diabetic, but my glucose numbers, my A1C suggests that I'm on the border.
What do you attribute that to?
I don't know, right? I mean, but 7 years ago, I didn't have a problem, right? Because I wore a continuous glucose monitor 7 years ago. That was the first time I did that, and it was like basically perfect. It was completely in line. And, you know, I geek out about this stuff, right? When I did that, I kept really close track of my diet. And I found, oh, yeah, if I'm spiking my blood sugar completely is based on the carbohydrates that I eat, and it wasn't so much out of range. But now, you know, 7 years later that I'm, you know, I mean, my diet's still clean. But the rice kills me. Rice is my, you know, rice is a problem. I go eat ramen. I eat pho. It decimates. I mean, my blood glucose goes sky high and stays high for a period of time. I'm like, okay, well, I can choose to do that, but this is what's going to happen. So I'm just working on trying to balance that. And I mean, I don't necessarily want to be on a ketogenic diet for the rest of my life, but the whole idea is just trying to find where that balance is.
And how old are you, Paul?
I'm 59. I just turned 59.
Right.
And I really don't have diabetes. I mean, there's no diabetes in my family history. I mean, my dad may have had it. He never went to the doctor. I mean, he refused. I'm like, Dad, I'll take you. You got to get your A1C done. I'll take you in. You just do it with me. You don't have to see a doctor. No, I don't need to do that. Right. I mean, he was, you know, didn't want to do anything. So, but there's really not that in my family history, right? Not much. My cardiovascular disease isn't really an issue. It's pretty longevity, but I just, you know, I pay attention to that because I can measure it. And I just look at that and I'm going to say, well, I know where I was 7 years ago and I'm still mindful of that. And I'm just trying to figure out how do I reel that all in, right? What's the right timing? And do I start my meal with carbohydrates? And, you know, if I'm going to eat rice, I'm going to pay a price for it. And again, I'm not saying that I don't eat rice, but I've cut way back on it. Like, I would rather be eating fruit. I'd rather be eating beans, you know, and that's just what I do. And I mean, I eat a fair amount of fat. I eat a fair amount of meat, right? I mean, you would look at my diet. It's a low carbohydrate diet. It's just not ketogenic low. And I want more balance in there too, right? And I really feel the fiber is beneficial for my digestive tract. So but anyways, that's the bean story, that I used to think, oh, beans are a problem and I'm going to get so much gas and I just eat them. They don't even bother me now. So even
you can
lentils.
develop, a not just a tolerance, but you kind of you fix your biome.
Yeah,
your,
I think your,
gut
your microbiome adapts to what you're eating, right? I mean, for sure. It changes.
Can you tell me how long we've been on the radio right now? Because I realized I didn't note our starting
time. Yeah,
we're at
15 minutes, so we still got a couple minutes before we need to.
The
question is, do we get caught up and we forget in 5 minutes? But I'll watch that. Anyway, so well, there's an introduction. We didn't even talk about protein leverage per se, but I'm all over the continuous glucose monitor. I know we talked about that in the past, right? I got my continuous glucose monitor on right now, and I'm not like, I'm just trying to look at how I can eat to just kind of flatten the curve a little bit, if that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
So that I will still eat carbohydrates, but I'm more mindful of the amount that I eat and when I eat them. And, you know, perhaps I'm not as concerned about my glucose spiking at night as I am in the morning. And I've actually like strayed a little bit from my intermittent fasting too. I've been eating more breakfast in the morning, which I haven't done in a long time, right? 15 years. I've gone a long time without eating breakfast. And now I'm starting to incorporate that a little bit just from the standpoint of trying to say, hey, I want to see what this has. Does this offer some better blood glucose tolerance for me eating more frequently? And also that I struggle to keep weight on, right? That's my problem.
Yeah.
Because you think like, wow, you're not fat. You don't get diabetes. But yeah, but there's many skinny diabetics. So actually getting fat protects you from diabetes. We've talked about that, haven't we?
Yeah.
So somebody that gets fat is able to turn their glucose into fat, so it's not glucose. It's glucose that's damaging in the bloodstream. I have a hard time doing that, right? I don't, and people be like, oh, you're lucky, you're lucky. I'm like, well, you look at my A1C and tell me whether I'm lucky or not, right? I mean, it's all this NO1 thing, right? We'd be very careful
to prejudge things. I was just going to say, your story and mine both are examples of how you have to keep focused on what's happening in your life and in your body and watch the signs and adjust accordingly. Do we want to go back to the protein sparing modified fast and the burden on the liver?
Yeah. So let's continue with because we covered some of the dangers of the high protein diet, but we didn't quite finish them.
Right.
So there's cardiovascular disease. I did want to talk a minute about TMAO, right? TMAO is trimethylamine N-oxide. Like that was a big deal, I don't know, 10 years, 5 years? I don't know how long ago that came out. Like TMAO is a metabolite that's produced by your gut bacteria, and it's from the breakdown of meat, right? Or choline and carnitine and things that we find in red meat, cysteine, that kind of thing. And that we find higher TMAO in meat-based diets, and then that is something that's a marker for cardiovascular disease, right? So that increases the risk of cardiovascular disease. So that was kind of a big thing, right? Certainly in the vegan world, like TMAO is evil, don't eat any meat. But you know, there's some issues with that. I mean, what we have to look at when we look at something like that, that's just a biomarker, right? So it's something that we can measure. And the question is whether that's a causal agent or whether that's just a biomarker, right? And what I mean by that is if you eat a lot of meat, you're going to have higher TMAO levels. That's just what goes along with that. Does that necessarily mean that that's a causative factor in cardiovascular disease, or is that just part of something else that's happening, right? So there's that piece. Plus, there's, you know, I mean, there's conflicting evidence on this, almost on anything, and that TMAO may actually be protective, right? Because it stabilizes protein and it reduces kind of cellular stress in the inside the cell membrane, that kind of thing. And the other thing is you get high TMAO levels with eating fish as well. It's not just red meat. So then the idea is like, oh, wait, so are we just going to blame red meat, or is it just all meat in general? But wait, fish may be protective, and you know, so it gets kind of murky on that. So I'm really hesitant to say, oh, TMAO is a cause of cardiovascular disease, but it's certainly a potential part of this, right? So again, there's a question mark on that. And we talked about saturated fat, and we talked about kidney function, we talked about calcium and bone health, but then also liver function, right? And me being a naturopath, like I get super interested in improving people's liver function, right? Like I would say, don't take a multivitamin, take something to support your liver, far more important, right? So this is that eating, you know, eating higher protein may create more of a burden on the liver. Now, again, same type kind of thing is, I think in a healthy functioning liver that we don't see that issue. In somebody that's got kind of an unhealthy liver, maybe potentially non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And even in that case, I'm not sure that I would say don't eat meat. I actually worry more about carbohydrates in that. But again, if there's sort of pre-existing liver disease, that may be more of a problem, because the liver does have to process the protein that we eat, right? It metabolizes the protein, and it also plays a role in when we convert the protein into energy. I talked about that last time, right? That we, if we really need energy, we can turn protein into energy, into glucose. Do you remember the name of that pathway? I got to ask you that because it's my favorite pathway. And I didn't say it last time, so you don't have any recent trigger to go on here.
No.
So the production of glucose from protein, or I mean, we use protein and some other things in the body too, but mainly protein. Gluconeogenesis. Production of new glucose.
I'm going to jump in and say thank you for tuning in to The Skeptical Naturopath with Dr. Paul Rattay and Christina DeRocher. You are listening to WDRT 91.9.
Thank you for remembering.
Yes.
Anyways, so gluconeogenesis. So when we turn protein into glucose, that's a burden on the liver, right? Burden meaning that's energy that's utilized. It could increase your liver enzymes. You also have to dispose of the waste product from that, and that's ammonia, right? Which is basically a nitrogen group. Because it's nitrogen that's in protein that makes it different from carbohydrates and fat. And if we're going to turn that protein and energy into glucose or even into fat, we have to remove that nitrogen group. And when we remove that nitrogen group, it's basically ammonia, and your liver has to manage that and excrete that. We'll excrete some ammonia in the urine. We'll also turn it into urea, which is in the urine, right? That's one way. And then also uric acid. Uric acid is like the crystalline form of ammonia, which is another way that the body gets rid of, you know, excess protein or wasted protein or metabolized protein, right? So on some level, right, you get some protein, or I'm sorry, you get some energy in your diet from carbohydrates and fat. And basically, if you eat some carbohydrates, you won't need to turn on gluconeogenesis as much, right? So again, there's maybe some balance here. It's not that we should just be eating all protein, but perhaps, you know, what's the right balance between those things? But again, I think that the liver, I don't know that there's a certain amount that you're like, oh, wow, you don't eat more than, you know, 200 grams a day, or, you know, there's some danger level that we hit at. It would still be the N-O-1 where we would like assess that and say, well, what are your liver enzymes, right? Do we actually see some manifestation of that damage or burden, let's call it? Right, same thing with kidney, like I talked about kidney disease. If you have kidney disease, we have to be careful with protein. If you don't have kidney disease, we don't care. It's not a problem. And I think the same thing goes for the liver. Though I would argue that in our lifestyle and what we're exposed to, we put a lot more burden on our liver anyways, right? Certainly want to improve, you know, is eating, you know, a lot of protein more damaging than drinking alcohol? Oh my gosh, alcohol is much worse. Like, don't get me started on alcohol. Let's prioritize concerns here. We're gonna fight about a high protein diet, and you drink a bunch of alcohol. We're focusing on the wrong thing.
Right.
So let's just keep that in perspective, is what I'm saying, right? And mm-hmm. not that it couldn't be a problem, but you know, I don't know that there's some amount that we say it's a problem. So
again, in episode one, we talked about how hard it is to OD on protein as well. I mean, it really is difficult. Is,
because you're going to stop. You stop eating. You're like, oh my God, I'm not going to eat anymore. Like, I'm done.
Really? And it's amazing.
And that's what we want.
I know.
I don't want to eat. I mean, that's classic. Like, oh, I can get you to eat less food if you just eat lean protein, right? Now we'll segue into the protein sparing modified fast, right? Which I started to talk about last episode, about basically taking people that are overweight. Now, these are people that have a lot of weight to lose, and we put them basically on a lean protein diet. White fish, turkey breast, chicken breast, and they eat about 600 to 700 calories of, you know, chicken breast a day. I mean, you talk about boring, that's boring. So what happens?
Oh my gosh.
So what do you think would happen? Now, you've been eating 3,000 calories a day, and now I'm giving you, and you have weight to lose. Let's be clear that you have weight to lose. Because if I go on a protein-sparing modified fast, I'm going to have a problem. I'm going to argue that if you go on a protein-sparing modified fast, you're going to have a problem. right? So now we're talking about overweight people that have a lot of weight to lose. So you put them on 600 calories of chicken breast, and what do you think they would say? What do you think would happen? That you say, well, do that for 2 weeks and come on back in and let's talk. What are they going to say?
Just hungry?
Yeah, you think, oh, they're hungry. They're starving, right? The semi-starvation neurosis kicks in. They're like, oh, my God, I got to eat. I got to eat. I mean, this is what we saw when Ansel Keys did his experiments on conscientious objectors in World War II up in, at the University of Minnesota, where they basically were starving these men, right, to see how they responded. And you start starving men and you don't feed them, and all they do is think about food. They dream about food. They, you know, that's all they do. So you'd think like, oh, 600 calories of chicken breast, you're going to be dying here. But that's not what they found. They actually found marked anorexia. What do I mean by marked anorexia? They don't want to eat. Wait a minute. You were eating 3,000 calories and I cut your calories by 75%? And you're telling me you don't want to eat. How is that possible?
The only thing I can think of is in macrobiotics, what I didn't realize when they kept saying only drink when you're thirsty, and you won't be very thirsty because most things you make in macrobiotics are made with water, such as soups, and you cook vegetables with water, and obviously grains take 2 and 3 cups per cup of grain in order to properly cook. And what I realized was I actually became dehydrated because it was a barometer. And so if I kept telling my body that I wasn't thirsty, I really didn't have thirst anymore, even though I needed liquid. So is that what happened?
I think it's different, right? So again, understand that the body needs, let's say, 1,200 calories a day. I mean, it's, again, going to vary a bit. But let's say you need 1,200 calories to run your brain, to run your heart, to run your all your metabolism, right? The core function. Not exercise, not movement, that kind of thing. But this is just to run those things. And if you don't get 1,200 calories a day, you're dead. Right? If you can't pump your heart, you're dead. If your brain doesn't have energy, and your brain is a huge energy hog, dead.
Right.
Death. That's what happens. So they're eating 600 calories. So they're already 600 calories under what they need. Where is that extra calorie? Because they need 1,200. So where's that extra 600 calories coming from? And I'd argue it's probably almost all the 1,200 calories coming from here. But where's that energy coming from that they need, those calories? And they're only eating 600.
I don't know.
From their fat cells. Because they've got a bunch of fat to lose.
Yeah.
So what you need to do is get them to use the fat that they stored for the rainy day that never, ever comes.
Right?
I mean, it's just, and the funny thing is, as soon as people start burning fat, I mean, it may take a couple of days, right? Their body will kind of fight that, and they're going to burn all the glucose and glycogen that they have. But eventually, because they don't have any fat and because they don't have any carbohydrate, they're not eating any energy or very little. I'm going to argue even chicken breasts, they're still getting fat in there. You'd be surprised that it's, you know, considered a low-fat diet, but it's not zero fat.
Right.
But it's low-fat. That all of a sudden they start feeling really good and they're not hungry because now they're using all of their fat. They're basically just accessing all the energy they need from their fat cells and they feel fantastic and they lose weight relatively quickly. And they don't want to eat because now they're in a point that they're burning their body fat. Right? So keto is a little bit of a variation on it, but not quite. Right, and I want to be clear on this. So ketogenesis means no carbs. So understand there's basically, I'm going to simplify this a little bit. 4 sources of energy that we're going to go to in the body, and we prioritize them. The first bin we go to is glucose. So glucose in your bloodstream is the first thing your body will use for energy. It's energy du jour. You have glucose in your body. Every cell in your body uses glucose. Your brain loves it. Your muscle, your liver loves it. Everybody loves glucose. Give me glucose. So that's in the bloodstream. Body will use that first. If the glucose goes away and that's been depleted, the next thing is glycogen. So glycogen being that carbohydrate store, right? Basically human starch. We store it in our liver and we store it in our muscles. So if we don't have enough glucose and the glucose is kind of waning, the body will be like, oh, well, I'll take over. I'll get it from glycogen. So now you start burning on glycogen. And understand, a ketogenic diet, you're taking both glucose and glycogen away, right? You're going to go through that within like 2 days. Within 2 days, you've used up all your glucose and glycogen. Gone. So what's the next thing that you go to? Now you go to fat. And that's the whole goal of ketosis, right? Is you're trying to get your body to burn fat. But here's the deal, and I probably said this before, is the first thing your body's going to use is exogenous fat. What's exogenous fat? Fat that you eat that's in your bloodstream from what you've consumed in your diet. And then once you've used that, then you go to stored fat, right? Endogenous fat, right? So that's something that that's the priority. So honestly, in a ketogenic diet, the fat is in the way because you're burning the fat that you ate rather than the fat that you've stored in your blood, stored in your body. And not that you can't get to it, you can, but understand you're eating a whole bunch of fat. That exogenous fat is going to basically be burned before you get to the endogenous fat. So people that follow a ketogenic diet, go ahead.
No, go ahead. People that follow the ketogenic diet,
they're burning, that don't lose weight, it's because they're eating too much fat. But they're like, but I have to eat fat because I have to be in ketosis. Yeah, ketosis
also,
means
they're going to starve as well because they're not eating anything that would create the glucose or the glycogen, right?
They're eating protein. So they actually, when they get adapted to a ketogenic diet, they can actually make some glycogen from that. It's not really efficient. It's much more efficient to eat carbohydrates on that. But the whole idea is you're trying to burn that body fat. And the glucose gets in the way, right? The glucose, the glycogen, and the exogenous fat will be burned before you actually go to your fat stores. So people that don't lose weight on a ketogenic diet are eating too much fat. But they're like, but that's what I'm supposed to be doing. Yeah, because you're in ketosis. But remember, ketosis doesn't tell me that you're burning your stored fat. It's telling me you're burning fat. Whether you ate it or whether it's from around your middle, I don't know. So the protein-sparing modified fast bypasses all of that, right? And again, that's why I like a ketogenic diet as a short term, because it's a sort of an easier way to get people to balance your blood sugar and to see if that works. But for some people, it doesn't work. And some people, they get worse on it too. I don't know that I've ever seen anybody gain weight on a ketogenic diet. I've never heard that, but I've certainly seen people that don't lose weight on a ketogenic diet. But understand that weight loss is not my goal. It may be a patient's goal. The goal is to get you to feel better. The goal is to improve your energy and decrease your hunger so that you really realize, hey, wow, you know, this is how I feel, and I can actually change what I eat and I feel different. And it's not me taking $500 worth of supplements a month.
Right.
Oh my God, don't get me started on supplements. And I use them, right? I use them all the time, but I'm like, how do we become less reliant on supplements because of the cost of them? It's just unbelievable. It's like highway robbery, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Anyways, so this is the idea of the protein sparing modified fast, is you're bypassing all of that, right? You're staying away from the carbs and you're staying away from the fat, and then you're just going to be start working on burning your fat. And then people feel really good, they lose weight quickly, this type of thing.
And what was the fourth source? Glucose, glycogen, fat, and
exogenous fat and an endogenous fat.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Fat that you consumed and then fat that you've stored.
Okay.
Because you're going to use what's in your bloodstream first, and your consumed fat is going to still be in your bloodstream till you do something with it.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's sort of the myth of the ketogenic diet. But understand, let's be clear here, right? You watch these TV shows. What's the TV show where they go off in the wild and they're, I mean, Lost? It's not Lost. Lost was a different
biggest,
one.
Biggest Loser?
Alone or no, not Big. Well, Biggest, that's a whole other story we could talk about. But the one where they're out in the wild, right? And they basically have a bow and arrow and, you know, they can bring like five things with
Survivor
them.
Survivor or something?
Yeah, something like that, right? And, you know, those people know what's going to happen. And the people that leave the show, what happens? They're like, you're dying of malnutrition. And what happens is, you know, they want to store as much fat as they can before they get on that show, before they go out in the wild. Because they're going to start burning their fat that they've stored, right? I mean, that's a human experiment, or the human experience, right? Feast or famine. And we're adapted to go a long time without eating, but we can't go forever.
Right.
So what happens is they become very lean, Yes. And so this is the same thing. And what they end up eating, right? They eat squirrels and they eat rabbits and they eat things that they can get. They end up eating a really lean meat diet. Right. So they're basically, I mean, not quite carnivore, right? Because carnivore would be you're getting more fat in there. But if you're just eating lean protein, which is basically the protein sparing modified fast, lean right. protein. But they're now having to leave the show because they're going to be malnourished and they don't have any energy, they have poor energy, they're getting sick, this kind of thing. And they got to like check out. That's rabbit starvation is what we call it. Right? People in the wild that eat rabbits because rabbits are relatively lean. There's not much fat there. And you're going to die of protein, excess protein. I mean, the protein poisoning, I'm not sure it's protein poisoning. It's just that you need some fat to kind of buffer that per se. So in other words, what is a good diet for somebody that's overweight is not a good diet for somebody that's normal weight or even underweight. So you understand that if I go on a lean protein diet, I'm running into trouble right away. It's not going to take long, right? I already said it's hard for me to gain weight, which means I'm not carrying around any excess stores. You put me on that show, I'm in trouble right away if I'm not getting some food with something with fat in it.
Right.
Or carbohydrate in it. It could be carbohydrate and or fat, but it's generally fat that we need to balance that out. So it's very curious. Again, remember, it's the N-of-1 and where you're at. And this was the problem in this trial. So they do this and it's really effective for people, but that's weight loss. That's not weight maintenance. Weight maintenance isn't being on a super lean protein diet for the rest of your life. You still need some fat. I would say you should eat some carbohydrates, right? I mean, I don't know that you need to eat a lot of them, but find out what your right balance is.
Yeah, watch your cravings.
Yeah, watch your cravings and see and say, hey, maybe I need this. I mean, I've seen patients on carnivore diet that I tell them, you need to eat a sweet potato. I mean, you don't have to go on a high carbohydrate diet. You've lost way too much weight. You're way too lean. I'm worried about protein starvation, rabbit starvation. Eat some carbohydrate. Generally they're eating fat. They're not in rabbit starvation because they're eating fat. But I'd be like, eat some carbohydrates. I think that will be beneficial for you. Right? Yeah. So as much as they're doing something that's valuable, it's almost like they're just kind of too far and they got to find more of a sort of a, can they get some balance in there? But people, people are people. They do something and they stick to it and they're gung-ho on it. Like one patient in specific, I mean, he was doing it for brain health, right? He was starting to feel like his brain was going. He was, late 70s. I'm like, great, go on the carnivore diet let's do it for 2 months, 3 months. We'll do it as a trial. 3 months comes, I'm like, how's your brain functioning? Not any different. I'm going to do it longer. I'm like, okay, I'm not sure this is working. Like we ran the experiment.
Right.
It didn't work. 3 months is more than long enough. Yeah. We don't see any effect. Eat some carbohydrates. You don't need to be, he's super lean. Like you're too far. It's too extreme. But again, I'm reading an N-of-1, right?
Right.
We have to adapt that. And again, I want to be clear that fats aren't the bad guys and carbs aren't the bad guys. It's just what's the right balance between them. And then we just eat in a culture where we refine them, we process them, we eat them out of context and we eat them by themselves. And then we dilute our protein and we don't get enough fiber and then we get into trouble. I mean, that's it in a nutshell. And the food industry knows that. They target it. Right? There's that idea of sensory-specific satiety. You know what that is? I had that on the list, right? So we had the satiety index. So you feel more satisfied if you eat more protein, if you eat more fiber. And then sensory-specific satiety means that if you eat the same kind of food over and over and over and over, you'll get exhausted on that. You won't want to eat it any longer.
Yes.
So even eating sugar, if you eat way too much sugar, you'll be like, eventually you don't want any sugar. So the food industry knows that and they manage things, right? So they mix them. They make sure there's a right balance of things so you're not getting too much of one thing so that you're going to be more likely to overconsume or consume more of it so we don't hit sensory-specific satiety. Very curious, right? So there's fat and there's carbohydrate and there's salt and they use all those things. They use them deliberately and they know what they're doing. Do you remember the guy that worked with worked with Dr. Pepper? Malcolm Gladwell, I think, talks about this in one of his books. Malcolm Gladwell, he's the New
Yorker. I know Malcolm
guy.
Gladwell, but I don't know the doctor.
But he's written some. Oh, he's not a doctor. He worked for Moskowitz or something. I can't remember. He was like a food optimizer. So he worked. So the food industry would hire him to figure out things. So Dr. Pepper hired him to figure out, you know, what's the right mix that they should have in their drinks. And they found out, what he found out by doing taste studies and all the work that he did, was they were putting too much syrup in their soda. Dr. Pepper was too much. So he said, oh, you got to cut it by, I don't know, 10% or something. And do you know how much money that saves Dr. Pepper?
Wow.
Because they're putting too much, oh yeah, billions of dollars. Because they realize we're doing too much, because we're trying to optimize that taste, you know, that taste, that sensory specific satiety. We want people to drink it and keep drinking it. And what is the right level to achieve that?
Mm.
I mean, is it evil? I don't know.
I mean, I don't know how they sleep at night personally.
I don't know either.
But I don't think that we should have regulations, because, you know, I just don't know how much we want to manhandle the N of one that people need to wake up to. You know, I just think it's a journey, and I don't know.
Yeah, but should we point the finger at the food industry? Because I think that's where the finger needs to be pointed. I don't know that we regulate them. I don't know the government can even go to battle with the beverage industry. You kidding me? Big soda? Huge. They propose a soda tax, and they'll do whatever they can to fight that soda tax. And even if the soda tax fights, then they'll figure out ways to get around it. Well, they'll lower the price of the product to the sellers, to the stores, to that kind of thing. They work around it. I mean, the problem with big soda is they're all profit.
Right.
So much profit, because they make their product on demand. They don't even have to store it. All they need is the syrup and then the water, which they probably just get right from wherever, and then they carbonate it. So they make it on demand. Have you ever been to a Coke bottler or a Pepsi bottler?
No, but I've been a waitress and had to set up the syrup box to the CO2.
Oh, yeah. Did you have them? I remember one manager that I had said, hey, don't use ice. We actually pay. It costs us more to put the ice in there than it does the soda.
I'm going to take a break really quick and say thank you so much for tuning in to WDRT 91.9, listener-supported radio on your dial. You're tuned in to The Skeptical Naturopath with Dr. Paul Rattay and Christina DeRocher.
Yeah, well, I've been to a Pepsi bottler, and I'm amazed at how small it is. I mean, it's still a pretty large operation, but you'd be like, wow, they're supplying all the Pepsi products in the entire metropolitan area, and it's not that big. You think that they have just stores and stores and stores of it. No, they make it on demand.
Yeah.
It's all profit. All they need to do is keep the syrup and the water that they use. And the raw material, you know, it's not like they actually have to have corn, or they have to have this product that they're going to turn into it. I mean, they have corn syrup, or they have sugar, or whatever they're using, but they can concentrate that into their, you know, into their syrup containers, which you know about. That's what you changed.
Anybody who goes to a restaurant and gets a free refill knows that it's not worth much if they're giving you a free refill.
Of course. They're probably being given that to them. You know, they basically get that for hardly anything. And it's still tremendous profit for the beverage industry. But so the government can't even fight them. What are they going to do? Tax them or do whatever? And the beverage industry responds. But, you know, that's what we got in this country. Lots of lobby power. But anyways, I mean, how much do we blame the food industry? Are we going to try to regulate this? And how do we regulate it? And, oh, wow, this food is good or this food is bad. And, you know, how
do we? I think it's so much more important to educate people about the facts of both sides of the situation. I mean,
sure.
It's so easy to see the ingredients of things and how processed. You know, you have something in your documentation as well about highly processed and ultra processed and not as processed. I think educating people so that they can make informed decisions is much more effective and won't get you on any hit list than trying to take down a conglomerate that's making billions. And quite frankly, I don't think the government has any incentive to take them down, because they are the ones who are paying the government to leave them alone.
Of course. Absolutely. So we gotta, you know, we have the best government money can buy. That's how it works. I mean, that's what leads to power. But yes, I agree that we educate people. But then the education is, you know, I can educate my children, right? And that's what I've done, right? I mean, I've done my best, and I mean, I've certainly shared the story with, you know, my oldest, right? Like, you're like, why do you buy any soda? Like, why would you ever buy soda? He's like, oh, because I need some taste in my water. Why do you need taste in your water? But he's like, Dad, I don't drink as much soda as my friends. I'm like, well, that's true. So you're better. But is there any tolerance for soda? Can you drink 2 sodas a week and be okay? Of course, right? I mean, you know, where do we draw the line? But how much can you get away with? And when does a little become a lot? And the food industry knows this too. Who do they target? They target the heavy users. They don't target me. I'm not a good, you know, they don't want to target me with their advertising because it's not going to work. Anyways, right. You know, where do we point that finger? But anyways, what else do we have about that? I talked about the keto diet. So yeah, the ultra processed food. So this is like, I talk about that as, or I list it as the protein decoys, right? So things we do to evade, you know, to avoid eating protein. Right, because again, understand protein is relatively expensive compared to other macronutrients.
Unless you're not eating a lot of anything else. My daughter brought up the same point. She said, how, you know, you were macrobiotic and you always talked about how relatively affordable macrobiotics is. How can you say that eating a lot of meat is affordable? And I said, because I don't even eat a lot of meat relative to how big my plate was with a macrobiotic dinner, so to speak. And then also, if you're only really eating the occasional vegetable and grain, and you're only eating meat, eggs, and I guess I do also buy avocados, bananas, some fruit, frozen. I can even buy frozen fruit for my smoothies. You know, like I feel like when, and this is the accountant in me coming out, to be quite honest, but I feel like when you are efficient with your diet, it isn't expensive. You know, when you're not buying junk food, like I haven't bought junk food regularly in 30 years. And I think that, well, longer than that. But my point is just, is that right? 30, 49? No, that's, yeah, it's a little bit less than that. But anyway, 28 years. And I feel like right there is the worth the cost of admission or something. And I also don't spend any time in doctor's offices or paying copays or whatever. So I always feel like I got to stand up and say something about how quote unquote expensive eating right is, because theoretically you're not hanging out in a doctor's office and you're eating and you're purchasing what you're actually wanting to eat. You know, I mean,
right. But that's paying attention to satiety and everything that you don't need as much. And I think that you're right about that, that if you're actually eating what your body needs, you don't need as much. But from a relative cost perspective, from a food manufacturer, all those processed carbohydrates are super, they're dirt cheap. So the idea is that you can buy more of it, right? So you go to Costco and you buy huge amounts of cereal. I mean, if you have a lot of cereal in your house, what are you more likely to consume?
Cereal,
and you got a lot of it? And I mean, I was raised on Honey Nut Cheerios. I'm sure there were days, I think I've said this, that all I ate was Honey Nut Cheerios. Oh my God, I love them. The crunch and the milk that's on that. I mean, like perfect, like that's what I'm driven for, right? And it's relatively dirt cheap, but you eat a whole bunch of it and you're getting very poor nutrition from that. So the idea is like, yeah, protein costs more, but you don't need as much of it. You're getting more bang for your buck, if you want to say that.
Yeah, exactly.
But relatively speaking, it's expensive. Do you know what I'm saying? But honestly, I mean, I go to the co-op, I can see things, organic vegetables cost as much as a pound of grass-fed beef does.
Right.
I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. You know, I'm going to buy a pound of Brussels sprouts for $6.99 or $7.99, and I can buy a pound of grass-fed beef for $7.99. Wow, let's make a choice there. Yeah, the Brussels sprouts have some protective properties and antioxidants and that kind of thing, but I'm not going to really fuel my day very well eating Brussels sprouts. Now, I cook them with bacon maybe, right, because I'm getting some energy and fat from the bacon. But by itself, I just spend as much as I spend on grass-fed beef. I got to make that choice, right? That I think that's what you're talking about, that it's much more, you know, you get a much denser, you get something that will actually feed you versus you're eating crappy carbohydrates that are really designed to have you eat more and more and more and more and more. And it may be cheap on the front end, but it's just like you keep eating a lot of cheap food, and then that's where we see obesity coming from. I'd say it's really difficult to gain weight on a high-protein diet. I suppose it's possible. I mean, I've never seen it. I don't know that I'm necessarily looking for that, but
I feel like I'm living proof. I didn't even do it for weight loss, although I did it more because I was feeling sluggish. I was feeling old and tired, and I thought, I have to try something else. And as soon as I did, and this was early August, and now it's what, not even mid-September.
Yeah.
And I feel fitter. I know that I weigh exactly the same because my clients have scales. I never have actually owned a scale, but I weigh myself at work just to see and just to prove to myself. I'm like, you know what? Maybe everybody's right. Because it was a little weird for me. I was 120 forever. And all of a sudden now I'm 140 and it doesn't budge. But I feel totally different. I weigh exactly the same practically. I might have lost a few pounds. But I feel 100% better just by eating, but just by leading with protein in every of my 1 to 2 meals a day, which, like I said, I'm also even eating less because I feel more sated throughout the day.
And how long did it take you to experience that?
I mean, days.
Yeah, right. It a week, probably a week, yes? For sure within 2 weeks, you knew there was a big change. I would,
sure.
But even
within 5 days, inwardly speaking, I'm saying I felt fitter. Yes. I didn't feel sluggish inwardly, even in 5 days. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, again, Christina, that's what we have to listen to.
Right.
Not lab tests, not, you know, other things. I mean, I talk about that with my A1C, so I get all geeked out about my A1C, partly because I can measure it and I know what it is, and then I get geeked out about a number instead of like, well, how do I feel? Like, do I actually feel better when my blood sugar is better balanced? I think I do, but, you know, I don't know that it's the huge difference, but I feel pretty good anyways.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But still, right now I'm micromanaging something. But the bottom line is you change your diet, it doesn't take long to know that you're on the right path. I mean, that's my whole point is like you could try any diet on. I don't mind as long as you're like using the right criteria to try to determine if this is working for you.
Right.
And do you feel different? And you're like, hey, there's something to this. Okay, well, maybe you don't have to follow it this extremely, but there's still something here. And if you go back to what you were doing before, everything's going
to
come right back.
Yeah,
I see that all the time.
I have to say, too, going grocery shopping, you know, maybe once every couple of weeks, I would get a bag of potato chips and polish it off. So maybe I have 2 bags of chips a month, you know, but I'm talking like not the party size, but like a regular bag of chips. And Annalena is not a big fan of chips. So I have to say it was mostly me. But when I go shopping now, I feel so good that I kind of don't want to wreck it either. So, you know, my favorite thing was the vegan or whatever they are. They're like the natural, and I use that word in total quotes, Twizzlers that they sell at Whole Foods. Yep. They have a natural foods Twizzler. And I look at it and I say, now, do I want to enjoy that or do I want to just enjoy how I feel and keep going with what I'm doing? So I have to say that you're right. You're definitely always welcome to just jump off and do whatever it was you were doing before. But I do feel like the longer you feel better, the more incentivized you are to just keep going and you know, keep enjoying what you're creating.
And then you go eat at Applebee's and you realize, I feel crappy every time I eat here, no matter what I get. Why am I eating here? Why am I doing this? Like, how many times do you have to slap me upside the head before I'm like, hey, wait a minute. I don't want to feel that way. And I'm just not going to do it. Either I'm going to eat before or I'm just not going to go. Or, you know, it's like eating out is like always some adventure for me. And it is usually an adventure that doesn't end well, even when I'm being super careful.
Right. Right.
Oh, my gosh. Because you don't know what you're getting. And I don't know. My digestion just falls apart when I eat out too much. Like we got back from camping and, you know, I've done this 100 times, so I know the deal, but we're out and we go for Thai food and, you know, we go to the co-op, but still my digestive falls apart. I'm like, oh, I'm not on my routine, whatever my routine is. And part of it is I just got to cook at home.
Exactly. I was going to say my routine is to have I think it's $4.99 a month. I have a New York Times cooking subscription
Oh,
online.
yes.
And the cool thing about it is, and then we have to end actually, we're at time. The cool thing about it is that you can put in any ingredient into the search engine and it will give you all the recipes in the database that have that ingredient. And so instead of going to a restaurant, I'll actually just put in something, some strange thing, or I'll look up their desserts and I find that I can eat something that's wild if I make it. You know what I mean? I know
Yes.
exactly what's going into it. Maybe it's super wide. You know, I've never made a souffle, but you know, you get the idea. It's like
Yes.
you can make something that's totally out of the norm, but you know exactly what went into it. You can buy the freshest, best ingredients and kind of go off, you know, off the rails that way.
So do you just have the New York Times food piece or not? Because I probably do that as an add-on. Now we're just talking about New York Times, because I get the New York Times and I get the news, right? But they always want to upsell me on everything. And I know I could get upselled on the food, but I never really thought about it. Like, maybe I need to consider that and do that.
I only have a subscription to cooking. And I think, I think it's like $4.99 a month.
Yes.
And I use it enough that it's worth it, because I'm looking at meat recipes now because I haven't cooked meat in forever, right? So now I'm like, oh, what's a good meatball recipe? And what's a good, you know, whatever. How can I cook this steak even better?
Oh, but are you sous-viding yet? Are you using sous-vide? Have you done that? You know what it is? That's cooking in water.
Oh, no. But now that you mentioned that about overcooking, that is my tendency. So I'm now going to be looking into that.
Sous-vide.
Anyway, we should end this radio program and talk offline.
Well, I got to get the New York Times food.
Yeah,
the
you can
food
add
part
it on
of that.
Just as a single
Yeah, I
thing.
Can add it on. Yeah, maybe I need to do that. So that's a good suggestion. And you can look into sous vide. Oh, I'm totally geeked out about that. That I'm cooking salmon at 120, wild salmon at 120.
Okay, I will definitely. Thank you so much, dear listeners, for tuning in to The Skeptical Naturopath with Dr. Paul Rattay and Christina DeRocher. You're listening to 91.9 WDRT. Look forward to next month's episode, hopefully, Immune Resilience. Cool.
Yay. All right, Christina. Thanks much.
You, Paul. Take good care.
Yeah, until next time.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.